We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu, W-I-L-L.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Well, company and affection are two benefits of living with a companion animal, and millions of us do. It's estimated that 40 million U.S. households own at least one dog, while almost 35 million households own at least one cat. Together with her husband, our guest today lives with three dogs and two cats. Our guest is Linda Case. She joins us this afternoon to talk about our relationships with cats and dogs. Linda Case is an adjunct assistant professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois and the author of four books about companion animals. Her latest is Canine and Feline Behavior and Training, a complete guide to understanding our two best friends. Listeners, join us with your questions about cats and dogs, cat and dog behavior and training. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Linda Case owns Autumn Gold Consulting and Dog Training Center in Mahomet. Autumn Gold provides classes for pet owners and their animals, along with seminars, training courses, and publications for pet owners and animal professionals. Her new book, Canine and Feline Behavior and Training, is published by Del Mar. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us, got a question or a comment, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Good to see you again. It's been a while.
You too, Celeste. It's great to be here.
So how are all the animals, human and canine and feline?
They are very well, thank you. In fact, we're kind of at a very good spot right now. We have three healthy dogs and two healthy cats, which is a really good place to be when you have multiple pets in your home.
Yeah. How did working with companion animals become your life's work?
Oh, goodness. That's going way back. Actually, I think I had the very good fortune to grow up not only in an animal-loving family, but in a professional family in terms of my mom was and still is a professional dog trainer. So I grew up training and showing dogs from a very young age. We trained our dogs primarily for obedience trials and tracking tests. And then I did my undergraduate work at Cornell in animal sciences and was, like almost every other Cornell undergraduate who is in animal sciences, I was pre-vet at the time, but also knew that I wanted to work in behavior, and I had also an interest in nutrition. So rather than going into veterinary behavior or veterinary science, which would have also been a great way to go, I ended up coming out here to the University of Illinois to do my graduate work in companion animal nutrition. And then subsequently, more good fortune, had the good experience of being hired to teach the companion animal program here in the animal sciences department. And I taught there for about 15 years and at the same time developed Autumn Gold Dog Training Center and Consulting. And just a few years ago, changed positions and went over to the vet school and also decreased my percent time so that I could spend more time writing and consulting.
Mm. Over the years you've been involved in training companion animals and in studying behavior, have there been significant changes in our thinking and our approaches to training and behavior?
You know, that's a great question, and I think I would answer that with a resounding yes. And I think for the most part, for the better. You know, when I grew up, you know, it was I had horses growing up as well, and at that time, the adage was, well, if the animal doesn't do what you want, you try and coerce them again, and if they don't do it, you coerce them more strongly, and if they don't still don't do it, you become even more physically abusive. And unfortunately, that was came out of beliefs about animals at that time, and also some of the beliefs about dog training and animal training in general that we inherited from World War II. And so that's all we knew at that time. We didn't know much about learning process. We didn't understand canine behavior or feline behavior to the degree that we do today. And there's been a movement really over the last 20 to 25 years away from coercive, confrontational, physically punishing methods towards methods that are focus more on positive reinforcement and that are non-confrontational. And also, I would argue that respect the animal for the species that that animal belongs to. Respects a dog for being a dog and a cat for being a cat, as opposed to trying to impose our will upon them and make them conform to what we perceive as humans to be normal behavior or acceptable behavior.
So you can achieve success without all that stress and anxiety on both ends of the leash.
Very true, exactly. And you know, I think that's a good point, is that, you know, the animal certainly was the one who suffered the most from those types of methods. But I think that our humanity suffers as well, in that, you know, we desensitize ourselves to methods that I think, on the face of it, if you looked at what we were doing, were quite offensive and quite inhumane. You know, we know now that we don't need to do that. We certainly don't need to do it for the vast cases of training, and I would even argue we don't and shouldn't need to do it in cases of aggression or cases of problematical behavior.
Well, talk with us a little bit about positive reinforcement and what it is and how you incorporate that in training and what kind of positive stimuli you use.
Sure. It's a great question. Basically, the premise of positive reinforcement comes from operant conditioning. And operant conditioning got its name from the concept that an animal is always operating on his or her environment. And basically, any behavior that an animal, and this includes humans, of course, offers is going to have a consequence. And that consequence will then affect whether or not the animal decides to repeat that behavior in the future. So when we incorporate the use of positive reinforcers or desirable reinforcers into our a training situation, all that we are doing is we're watching the animal and saying, well, how is this animal operating on his or her environment? What is he doing? And how can we selectively offer reinforcers to basically shape behaviors towards behaviors that are desirable and acceptable and that are mutually beneficial to the bond between us and our animals. So we look at what the animal offers naturally, and then using good timing, using shaping, basically teaching people to observe their animal, we can kind of move that animal towards behaviors that we like, and we can extinguish behaviors that perhaps we don't like quite so much.
Yeah. Now, I'm not quite sure what you mean by timing and shaping.
Okay. Timing refers to, you know, if we think of an animal as always behaving, just like humans, we're always doing something. And so the timing is very important in that when you offer an animal something desirable, a good, you know, we say positive reinforcer, and that's a little bit of a misnomer, because a positive reinforcer is just anything that increases behavior. So we really look at desirable consequences. And for pets, that includes food. Treats are certainly a big primary reinforcer. Petting, pleasant voice, human interaction. So we take those desirable consequences and we say, when can we provide those exactly at the time or immediately after the behavior that the animal offers that we want to increase? And if we miss that timing, if we wait too long or we provide the positive stuff too soon, we basically don't really hurt anything. We just don't get the behavior that we want. A really good example, we work on this in our beginner classes quite often, is teaching a dog to do a sit stay. The behavior that you want to increase is to basically sit quietly and calmly. And many people, especially people with young dogs, want their dog to sit quietly and calmly. And so it's a behavior that people are very interested in increasing. Well, traditionally, again, thinking like humans, we would look at it that, okay, we're going to teach the dog to sit and hold a sit stay, basically to freeze in place, which is difficult for a young, exuberant dog. And human thinking, we think, well, at the end of that behavior, we release the dog and say, okay, here's a treat. You were such a good dog for maintaining that sit stay. And so we're providing all this great stuff as the dog jumps up and says, yay, we're done.
Yeah.
Well, from the dog's point of view at that point, you know, what's being reinforced is the end of the sit stay or jumping up.
Yeah.
Right. And so the timing in that case would basically be dog sitting, good stay. That is such a good stay. Here's a treat. Oh, you're such a good dog. 5-10 seconds. The release then is, okay, fun's over. Nothing for the release. And again, that's something that, you know, we drill into our students. And it's hard from a human standpoint for people to get that. Because from a human standpoint, we want to say, wow, you did such a great job there. Which humans can understand because we can understand that delay much better than an animal can. I would probably argue that it would work better for people to also, you know, work on timing a little more. But at least with the spoken language, we can, we're able to understand that delay more.
It's
than
It's also a good reminder that this is a dog, this is a cat, this is not a human being.
Sure, sure. And I would say that, you know, we want to be careful not to make that distinction too strong because certainly dogs and cats do share many of the same emotions that we do and also will show the same responses in similar, you know, they show the same fear to response to an aversive stimulus that we do. But we should always be aware of species-specific behaviors and motivations.
Yeah. One of the things that was really interesting to read in your book, Canine and Feline Behavior and Training, is that cats and dogs are very social animals.
Yes, yes.
And social isolation is stressful.
Yes, definitely. And I think I'm glad that you included cats in that. One of the reasons that I wrote the book the way that I did was to dispel a lot of the myths that we carry forward, even, you know, as we become more understanding of our dogs and cats, about dogs and cats. And one of those myths, of course, is that the cat is aloof and independent and asocial, which we know for certain is just completely untrue.
Yeah. Well, we have a cat, very affectionate, and when we've gone away and had someone come and stay with him, the cat sitter reports, this cat would rather be affectionate with you rather than have dinner.
Yes, sure.
So
sure.
The first thing, you know, that happens when the human being comes in the door is the cat is there greeting
sure.
and, you know, hey, and yes. wants to, you know, be right next to you, not on your lap, but
right
there with
sure.
you.
We call those Velcro cats.
Yeah,
yes,
Velcro
yes.
cat. Velcro cat, yes. indeed. And then after that ritual, then it's time for, well, maybe now we could have a little something.
A little bowl. Snack.
Yeah.
Sure.
This is
sure.
the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, animal trainer, companion animal trainer, Linda Case. She is an adjunct assistant professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois, and she owns Autumn Gold Consulting and Dog Training Center in Mahomet. Her latest book is Canine and Feline Behavior and Training, A Complete Guide to Understanding Our Two Best Friends. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on a cell phone. Line one. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Thanks for having the show.
Sure.
Linda, I wanted to ask you a question about dogs being learning in a social situation. I have an English Toy Terrier, Manchester Terrier, and he's about 3-4 years old. And he's learned a bad habit from his my mother-in-law's Boston Terrier
mm-hmm.
that is, I consider, untrainable. the Boston Terrier. Our dog has taken up climbing up on a chair and then onto the table after the mealtime.
Oh, dear. Okay.
And scouting around for leftovers.
Sure.
And the mother-in-law's dog will do it you know, within eyeshot of you. He doesn't care. Mm-hmm. Like, our dog knows it's bad, but he never did that before he saw the other dog doing it.
Okay. And you actually witnessed this, that you witnessed him seeing the other dog do it or and participating? Or?
Well, yeah, they spend a good bit of time together.
Oh, they do? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's really the only place he could have, you know, in at least 2-3 years, I think that's got to be it. I mean, I haven't seen him, like, looking at him, but they've been in the
sure.
same room.
Sure, and
know,
this behavior
was going on, and this dog, this Boston Terrier does it, you know, daily.
Right, sure, sure. Well, I guess the first thing that I probably wouldn't touch is the fact that this whole mother-in-law's dog thing, but that's something that, you know, the mother-in-law's dog not behaving is probably more a family issue there. But in terms of social learning, yes, we know now, it used to be thought that dogs do not participate in social learning or do not, it's not one of the main ways that they learn, but we know from recent studies just in the last 5 years that they actually are quite proficient at learning in social ways. And basically, in the case that you're describing, there are several things that are probably going on. And, you know, first is that your dog witnessed the other dog climbing on the table and was also able to immediately experience the contingencies, the reinforcers, you know, oh, so-and-so's up there, I can smell food, I'm going to follow him up there and basically have the same reinforcer. So it probably was just one event learning in that case, in that your dog saw the behavior or followed the behavior, followed your mother-in-law's dog up onto the table, and then immediately was reinforced in the same way. From that point on, you know, the presence or absence of the mother-in-law's dog was really irrelevant because those are some good yummies, you know, climbing up on the table. So in terms of changing the behavior, you certainly have to prevent it first and foremost. And if you're, you know, if the dogs are allowed to just be in a room that has a table and has a chair, and each time that they go up, they're getting reinforced by, you know, eating leftovers, you're not going to be able to change the behavior at all, you know, clearly. And the point I do want to make about, you mentioned that your dog knows it's wrong. He doesn't really know that it's wrong. He knows what works. And probably what's happened is that he has learned that he or she, I'm sorry, you didn't say your dog's sex. He?
It's male.
Male. What he's learned is that going up on the table when you or other humans aren't in the room equals the consequences are good. You know, get lots of yummies, no bad consequences there. Most probably, he has gotten reprimanded when you have seen him, and he quickly does that math and learns, oh, going up on the table in the presence of humans does not end up in good consequences. It ends up in being hollered at or being swatted or not getting the goodies. And so what they learn very quickly is get up on the table when no one's there and you get reinforced, avoid the table when someone's in the room, and that way you can avoid something bad happening to you. So it's really not that they learn it's right or wrong. They just learn what works in terms of contingencies and reinforcers.
Sure. My mistake with semantics. I mean, I don't think a dog particularly knows right or wrong. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Right or wrong, and you know, in the same
in a human perspective.
Exactly. So you know, basically, in terms of changing the behavior, the first thing, you know, I would recommend in this case is, you know, pick up the table right after you eat and get those reinforcers off the table. The other thing that we do is we try and change the dog's focus from being reinforced by things up to being reinforced by things down. And so I would suggest when you're eating dinner to stuff some bones, to have some really good yummies that only come out at dinner time. And you can even hide those around the room. You can make a little game of it so that your dog basically comes into the dining room and says, wow, you know, there's always something really cool on the floor here, rather than looking for her reinforcers up on the table. The other thing that I'd recommend is just some good basic obedience training, you know, that she can be taught to do a downstay on a rug while you're eating dinner. Then when you're done with dinner, she leaves the room so that she doesn't have the opportunity to jump up on the table. And also, oh, I'm sorry, you said he, also that he doesn't have, he does have the opportunity to earn reinforcers in other ways. You know, again, traditionally we tend to focus way too much on how do we correct a behavior, how do we stop a behavior we don't like, and we ignore then the opportunity to provide behaviors that are good for the animal, that the animal redirects towards. Another response that will earn some reinforcement that is incompatible with getting up on the table. So, you know, looking around on the floor for good things or doing a downstairs incompatible with, you know, cruising around on top of your table. But if your mother-in-law is not willing to work with her dog, you're really in a bad place then. So you're going to have to separate the dogs or convince her to do some training as well.
Yeah. Okay. Good advice. I'll just have one more comment to something you were saying early on. It's never ceases to amaze me. It seems like kind of the backwardsness of, quote, scientists. I mean, when you talk about dogs learning social people didn't think that was possible just a little bit ago.
That's very
true. Like a no-brainer.
I agree.
If you read anything about wolves, it's completely, I mean, how would they learn anything? I mean, it'd all be just genetically.
And it's a highly social species, sure.
Like we know how to do whatever. I mean, it's
yeah, ironically, because of some studies that were done when they're basically going way back to the Skinner box, ironically, some of the first studies that were done with observational learning or social learning, you know, which is observational learning is a type of social learning, was done just inadvertently with cats, which are, you know, relatively less social species than the dog. So lo and behold, then, you know, the conventional wisdom was, oh, cats can learn socially, but dogs can't, which is, when you think of it, it's pretty ridiculous when a dog has, as you said, evolved from a highly social species. So it just took the right experiments to say, yeah, they're quite good at it, actually.
Thanks for the call, and we'll go on and take another call from a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. I have two questions. The first one is, I have a 4-year-old male golden retriever, and I just wonder if this particular behavior is common. He likes to, when I'm sitting down, or even standing, he likes to back up to me and sit on my foot.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very sweet when he was little, but now he's 90 pounds, and it's actually quite uncomfortable, and I don't want to all of a sudden change my accepting behavior.
Sure,
and
sure.
Make him think that he's doing something wrong.
Sure.
But is this common with dogs?
Well, you're really describing social contact, and what's possible, and I would probably say probable, is that when you said you thought it was quite delightful when he was, you know, little, you probably reinforced it by saying, oh, that's so sweet, and petting him. And being a golden retriever, I'm sure he enjoys that social interaction, that petting. So for him, that may have just become a habitual way of socially interacting with you. You know, for him, sitting on your foot always predicts good petting. So he knows, oh, you know, if I sit on mommy's foot, she gives me some love, and it's a really nice situation. So, you know, he didn't really realize that as he was getting bigger, he was squashing your foot, you know. So I think that it's really commendable that you recognize that you don't want to abruptly change that behavior. So what you could do is start to ask him for a sit facing you or even a down. I don't know if he's had basic training. And then start to what we call beef up that behavior. So I would start to strongly reinforce that behavior. Mm-hmm. And I would also, usually when these things happen, the guardian can say, oh, you know, he tends to do it when I sit down at night and I'm, you know, getting ready to watch a little TV, or he tends to do it when we're eating. So if you have a good sense of when he offers that behavior, then we would want you to show some what we call preemptive training. So if you know, okay, this is a time that he typically sits on my foot, as he approaches you, you would just say, hey, Muffin, sit.
Yeah.
Or hey, Muffin, down, prior or before he offers the behavior.
Right.
And then just beef that up. You know, good boy, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Give the same loving to him. If there are some times, you know, as you offer that training to him, that he, you know, you miss it and he sits on your foot, all you do is just walk away. And then just call him over, ask him to sit towards you again or down. Again, whatever behavior you choose, that's a different response. And then reinforce that behavior and stop reinforcing the sitting on your foot.
Or I could get some steel-toed shoes and
yes.
go on.
Yes,
but,
yes.
The other quick thing is, when he was very young, under 6 months, he had a floating patella. and had to have it repaired. And it's been quite successful. But I have noticed a male dog, and he does not ever lift his leg to urinate.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's because of that, or do some male dogs just not do that?
Yes, some just don't. Was he neutered at a young age?
Pardon me?
Do you know what age was he neutered?
Probably around 5 months.
Yeah, some dogs, if they're neutered young, you will see them, they won't lift their leg. The other thing that leg lifting is related to is the dog's canine social group. Is he an only dog, or does he?
Yeah, he's in the only. I mean, he runs into dogs outside, but not on a daily basis.
Yeah, so we'll see it more frequently in dogs who do not share their lives with other dogs, especially other male dogs.
Okay.
Because when dogs do lift their legs, it's called raised leg urination posture. It is a more typical marking posture, and that is related to a dog's social group.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it doesn't reflect on his masculinity one way or the other.
Well, he's pretty confident in his territory. So.
Sure, sure. So it's not a big deal one way or the other.
Okay.
Some dogs do, some dogs don't.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We take another call now. A listener in Champaign waiting for us on line three. Hi. Line three.
Is this me?
Yep, that's you.
Okay. I have a question about an F3 Savannah cat. So it's 12.5% serval.
Okay.
And as a kitten, when I got her, she was on feline pine as cat litter. And she didn't like it at all. She used it, but she preferred to just, like, sneak into the most remote dark corner of the basement and do it there on the carpet. So I switched her to Tidy Cat. Oh, and she loved the Tidy Cat, and we were doing great with the Tidy Cat. And then I trained her to go on walks on her harness and leash.
Great, okay.
So I take her on walks, and now she likes to do it on the grass.
Okay.
On the lawn, just like my Bichon.
Okay.
They walk together, and they do their thing. And only the cat now will not use the litter box.
Okay.
And instead of using the litter box, again, now goes to the most remote corner of the basement and does it in this one spot that's carpeted.
Okay. And how old is she, did you say?
1 year.
She's 1 year. What you're describing is probably a surface preference, which is very common in cats when we see house training or house soiling problems with cats. And what the scenario that you describe, and I would say, you did everything right in changing the substrate that you were using. So when she was young and she developed the substrate preference for the carpet, then, you realized, well, could be the litter, and you changed it, which was a great thing to do. And you found a substrate that she liked, so she was then using the litter box again. Is this for urination and defecation, or...? Or just is she just urinating outside the box?
She's just defecating.
Oh, she's just defecating. Okay, that's more unusual. Okay. Because usually what happens...
She's part serval, and I think their behaviors are a little different, I think. I don't know.
Well, she's also... Didn't you say she's only 1/12 serval?
So, yeah.
Yeah, so 11/12 of their domestic cat. Regardless, serval cats are still going to show pretty similar elimination habits. So basically you have a cat that's already telling you her surface preference is for absorbent surfaces, and that's what we immediately go to when we hear carpet. Sometimes cats also have location preferences, and so the fact that she's going to the same spot, it's possible it's a location preference. But the fact that she switched back again after you started walking her outside kind of just screams at me, surface preference for absorbent surfaces. Because when you're walking outside, the grass is going to be a softer feel, and it may be, I don't know if the carpet is what type of...
Pads it out, down in that?
You sure could. You might even want to put a little grass in your... so it really could have to do with the fact that you had a change in preference for this. Now, the other thing I would add here, which we always immediately go to with any type of house soiling problem, is a check with your vet first. When it's defecation, we immediately think that there could be some type of parasite problem or a diet problem. Believe it or not, some cats, we tend to feed pretty highly digestible foods to cats today, and that can lead to actually constipation in some cats, which then leads to a house soiling problem, because anytime a cat associates any type of discomfort or pain with elimination, the first thing they think is, well, it must be that litter box. And so they'll stop using the box. So I would still do a check with your vet, even though the sequence you describe does seem to indicate a surface preference. I think it's a wonderful thing that you're out walking her, so I wouldn't say stop that. So I'd probably lean more towards
the highlight of her.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a great thing to do. So I would probably say let's go back towards trying to get her enjoying, both preferences, having a surface preference for both. I guess I should ask, too, you've never reprimanded her for going outside the box, have you?
No, I don't think that works unless you're like a catcher right in the act.
No, I wouldn't even if you catch her. No. Even if you catch her in the act, do nothing, because basically the reason I ask is you said she went into a remote area, and whenever we hear that, we think if there was any kind of aversive used while she was urinating or defecating, the first thing cats and dogs learn is to eliminate outside of the presence of the owner. And so, if she's going in a remote area, she may be saying, well, if I don't use my box, Dad doesn't like it, so I'll just hide. If you did.
Oh, that's interesting, because I've never reprimanded her.
No, I'm not saying you did. I just wanted to ask because of the circumstances you described. So, again, I would probably say.
I just figure she doesn't want to do it in the living area.
Well, that's true, but she developed this preference quite a while ago. So she just went back to a previous preference, surface and possibly
right.
Location.
The place where she initially started doing it when I got her.
Right, exactly.
Now back to the same place.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So, I think it is a surface preference. With regards to the previous caller, I had an early neuter dog that would squat.
Sure.
And then we took care of a friend's dog that was a leg lifter.
Mm-hmm.
And he just started lifting.
Sure.
He's
like, oh, so that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah,
sure.
Right. All right. Thanks.
You're
thanks
welcome.
For the call. Another example of animals
learning right.
from one another.
Sure.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Linda Case. She owns Autumn Gold Consulting and Dog Training in Mahomet. She's also an adjunct assistant professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois. She's the author of a number of books on companion animals, her latest, Canine and Feline Behavior and Training, a complete guide to understanding our two best friends. By the way, she and her husband have three dogs and
yes.
two cats. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments about our relationships with cats and dogs. Maybe you have a behavior or training question. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. With your background in animal nutrition, maybe since this last call you mentioned, what are you feeding?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you would talk with us about what we should think about in terms of selecting foods for our animals.
Sure. It's a good question. Again, just as we've gained a lot of knowledge in the last 20, 25 years about behavior and training, that's also true about companion animal nutrition. And today, I think more than any other point in time, we know a lot about stage of life feeding and lifestyle feeding. I grew up in the era, and I imagine you probably did too, Celeste, that one food from puppyhood mm-hmm. to throughout life, and that was a real marketing coup because that was sold to us and said, "Wow, really neat! You can just take this one food and from puppyhood through old age, it's going to do great by your dog." And if you think on the face of it, that's kind of a ridiculous claim because just like humans, dogs and cats go through different developmental periods. They go through periods of different activity levels, different lifestyles, and so we do know that we can basically niche feed to those life stages and lifestyles. And for dogs, we also know that size of the dog's breed is very important in terms of selecting a food, especially during growth and to some degree for adulthood. So the first thing I would say is think about your dog's age, The type of life that they lead, how active they are, what types of activities you are involved in with them, their health status. We know a lot about, just as with human nutrition, both preventative and management of certain diseases for dogs and cats today. And then select a food based upon, if you're going with a commercial food, the company's reputation. You know, we call them premium foods, for lack of a better word, but a food that's been adequately tested and has had good research, good nutritional research behind it. And, you know, an easy way to look at that is just look at a nationally known company that has a website that gives you plenty of information about their food and is willing to give you additional information than what's just on the bag and answer your questions about the food.
Okay. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Linda Case. Let's take another call. Listener in Levington on line one. Hello.
Morning. Afternoon.
Hi.
Hey, I got a Jack Russell mix. She's two-thirds, three-quarters Jack Russell, I think. And I know the daddy's full Jack Russell, and the mama is about half. But anyway, she's about a year old now, and pretty much everybody this will happen to a little bit. More familiar with you she is, the less it'll happen. But she just yaps at people and bites them on the legs. I mean, it's like the definition of the ankle biter. And really, with her, it almost seems like, you know, trying to kick at her just, you know, makes her happier to do it. The most effective way to deal with her is really just to say no, it seems. But I just wondered if there's anything we can do that'd be more effective.
Did you say she's more likely to do it if she doesn't know the person, or she's more likely to do it if she does know the person?
Well, she's kind of a typical dog. You know, some people walk in and, you know, a dog's never bitten me in my life, and, you know, those kind of people, and she doesn't bother them, you know. But in general, the less she knows somebody, the more likely she is to bite at their legs. And I don't know. Sometimes it almost seems like she forgot who you are.
Mm-hmm. And this only happens when people come into your home?
Yeah. Well, she's outdoors and indoors, so.
So they come into your yard as well?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Pretty much anytime anybody comes around her, you know, on a walk or something.
Sure.
You know, when she's on a leash, it's easier to take care of because she knows she's on the leash and she knows she's not going to get away with any of that.
Right. Well, the fact that she's doing it to people she doesn't know, and the fact that it sounds like she's less likely to do it when she knows you, would suggest that it's out of anxiety or nervousness or timidity. Even though it's aggression, you know, people think, oh, well, she's being aggressive. She must, you know, be trying to defend something, or it's not related to fear. The vast, vast majority of aggressive responses we see in dogs and in cats are related to anxiety and usually to fear. And if you think about it, you know, she's the size of a little peanut. She's very small, and people are invading her territory. They're coming into her yard or her home. She doesn't know them well. And probably what has happened in the past is she's, you know, started barking. They still come in because she's little and they're not intimidated. She's nipped at somebody's ankle, and most people are, you know, that have functioning neurons are going to jump back because that hurts. And from her point of view, then that behavior, nipping at their feet, just worked to make them back up a little bit. And right there, you have a response, a contingency going on that's going to reinforce that behavior. Again, even though it's paradoxical, it seems like, gosh, why would she be aggressive if she's nervous? Usually there's a what we call a reinforcement history here, that she's tried barking, they keep coming in, she's more nervous, then she escalates to a little nip, they step back because that hurts, and she says, oh, okay, you know, not even consciously, that's what works. So the first thing I would do is get some basic obedience training with her and get into a program we call response substitution that basically means we need to teach her that sitting or coming or going to a spot is a behavior that's incompatible with biting, and that behavior also is another way of relieving her anxiety because you want to make her comfortable, you know, and she's, you know, dogs who bite for any reason are not happy dogs, period. She's not doing this for entertainment, so she's anxious at the very least. And so one of the things that you can do is to teach her, go to your bed when somebody comes in, and you're going to get lots of good stuff that'll reduce her anxiety without having to bite. and you're giving her a substitute response for under your bed that is incompatible with rushing someone and biting at them. In this case, since it sounds like she hasn't had any obedience training, the first thing I would say is either get her into a reputable school for just good basic sit down, come, stay, walk on a leash, or have a private consultant come into your home to help you with that.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got a couple of other people waiting to talk with Linda Case this afternoon, and we're coming down on time. We go next to a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a two-year-old yellow lab, great dog. I've only had it for about 8 months, I guess. But the problem I have is that, well, the dog is just really partial to me, wants to be wherever I am. That's fine, but I cannot seem to train him to stay in the backyard. I mean, we have a fenced-in backyard, and if I put him in the backyard, he just sits on the top step looking in pitifully. He just will not play out there. And I'm wondering, am I barking up the wrong tree, so to speak, to try to train him to do that? I mean, is that just the nature of the lab, or
what is your expectation of what he should be doing out there?
Well, I would think that it's a nice day. You know, I throw his ball out there or a bone or something, that he would spend some time out there without, you know, any of us being around.
Right. And again, what would he be doing?
Oh, I don't know. Just we live on a corner. There are a lot of people that walk by. I know he loves it when people walk by, especially with dogs. I would think he'd just be entertained outside. He's just not an outdoor dog at all unless one of us is out there. And is that just normal?
It's completely normal. In fact, I think that maybe we need to change your expectations rather than change his behavior. Because you know, with dogs, it's been a case of we want to have our cake and eat it too. We've created these dogs by selecting four dogs that easily bond to humans, that accept humans as their primary social group, and then we turn around and say, "Here, go outside by yourself." So he's just saying to you, "I don't want to be by myself. The background is just some place I eliminate. I want to be with you." So I would say, if you do go outside with him, you know, you mentioned that you throw a ball for him. He probably loves that. Go out and play retrieve with him. Or the other great thing to do is to take him for walks in the neighborhood. You know, so basically outside is great, but he wants to be outside enjoying his bond with you. And so I think that it sounds like you like this dog a lot and that you accept that he's bonded to you. So maybe the way to change how you think about this is to think, well, what can I do outside with him that's fun for both of us? And that way he can have his exercise and his outdoor time. You know, one of the things you mentioned that I thought was really sweet was you said he likes watching people go by. Which probably means he likes other people and likes to meet new folks. So, you know, instead of saying, you know, hey, go out and do that on your own, go with him. You know, take him for a walk and meet people in the neighborhood, have kids come up and say hi to him. So maybe just kind of change what your thoughts are about what outdoors is, and then both of you would be more happy about the whole situation.
Well, I mean, I agree with what you're saying, and I certainly do those things. Plus, he loves playing Frisbee. But it's just not, you know, you cannot entertain your dog all the time. You can't be catering to your dog all the time. So I guess what I was thinking is that those times that I put him outside by himself, I was hoping I could sort of train him to be on his own. But you're saying that that's just not going to happen.
Well, you certainly can beef up the yard by giving him some interactive toys outside. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that shouldn't take the place of human interaction. You know, but he could just as easily do that inside, too, that you could give him stuffed bones, give him interactive toys inside. You know, I don't know what's so special about the yard. You know, again, I think that our beliefs about yards and outdoors come from days on the farm when dogs were outdoors more, but so were we. So it is kind of, you know, it's probably not fair to the dog to expect him to be out there by himself because from his point of view, it's just a place to poop and pee. There's nothing special about the yard from his point of view.
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Sounds like she's a lucky woman to have such an attentive dog.
True, to have a dog love you like that. There's nothing more ego-strengthening than that.
Yeah. I do wonder, though, you know, if you've got an animal that is like our Velcro cat, mm-hmm. you know, and you kind of you need to get something done.
Sure. You know, what to do.
Yeah.
Sure, and I think that's a good point. You know, there weren't any indications that this dog had any separation stress going on, or we would have gone down that road. But certainly I think it's a good point because, we do have to teach our dogs to accept alone time. It used to be thought that dogs who were hyper-attached, that meant they were going to have separation anxiety. And actually, we know now that dogs who have separation anxiety tend to show strong attachment behaviors, but the opposite is not true. Dogs that are highly attached do not necessarily show separation anxiety. So when we hear of a dog who's highly attached who isn't showing separation stress, you know, we'd say, well, just, you know, come up with ways that this dog can be comfortable and happy when you're at home, when you're not having to, quote-unquote, entertain him, and that can be a stuffed bone. And again, if you're relying too much on toys, that's a little red flag to me that the dog really isn't getting enough exercise, because when dogs get enough physical and emotional stimulation, mm-hmm. and the emotional part or the intellectual part is as important. You know, if you do the same walk with your dog every day, that becomes very boring to them because they know every house, they know every smell. If you even just change your walk 3 or 4 times a week, that is very emotionally stimulating and mentally stimulating for the dog. Yes. So if, you know, a case where the dog's not showing separation anxiety is showing, gosh, I'm bored, you know, what should I do? We first go to, well, let's look at how much this dog's needs
are
being
met. They can't pick up a book.
Exactly.
Okay. There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Linda, thanks so much for coming
in. Oh, thank you for inviting me. I was happy to be here.
Linda Case. She owns Autumn Gold Consulting and Dog Training Center in Mahomet, and she is also an adjunct assistant professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois, and the author of a number of books about companion animals. Her latest is Canine and Feline Behavior and Training, A Complete Guide to Understanding Our Two Best Friends.